So I'm here with Noel Paul. Is it Noel?
Yeah.
Best way to... I'm really bad with pronunciation.
No, that's fine. That's
and
great.
Paul is good. So Noel Paul, who is here at South by Southwest with his short film, Annie Goes Boating. It's a short 3D film. And do you have another film here, too?
I have a music video here, yeah, okay. That I co-directed with my friend Stefan Moore. Uh-huh. We have a directing collective called That Go. And we have a music video called Golden Prize in the music video competition.
Yeah. But we're not going to talk about that. But it's great to know about. Let's talk about this 3D short film, which, you know, it's screened with a non-3D film. I think you might be the only sort of indie 3D film that has come across my radar. I'm not sure who else is doing this. So let's talk about why 3D?
Well, this Annie Goes Boating is my thesis film, and I have been really interested in the 3D format because I really love 3D movies, but I get tired of seeing kind of the same genres. I thought Avatar was really amazing, and I thought Up was really great, and G-Force was really entertaining. but I'm just really interested in seeing what would happen if you take the kinds of films that I really, really love, which tend to be smaller films, dramas about people, and if you made films like that in 3D. So I really wanted to do that, and I was really fortunate because I kind of had all of the pieces in place in order to do that with no money. When a few years ago, while I was a younger student in grad school, I helped write a grant to outfit our school with a stereo 3D rig. And it was for smaller cameras than the ones I was able to use on Annie Goes Boating. But through that grant writing process, I came into contact with this really amazing 3D firm called Lightspeed Design. And they make a technology called DepthQ. And they do some production work. They develop a lot of technology. They do a lot of stuff with like fiber optic microscopic 3D rigs for surgery. They're just kind of like these genius dudes who have been doing really high-end stereo stuff for years, like decades. So I knew them. And then I had also helped write a grant to get a RED camera for my school. And then my cinematographer, Michael Reagan, that I work with a lot on music videos, is an owner-operator of a RED. So I kind of had two REDs. So I went to Lightspeed and said, hey, I've got two REDs. Do you guys have a camera rig that I can put them in because I want to make a 3D film with them? And, you know, they took an interest in me, and so they not only gave me a beam splitter rig, but they kind of trained me in stereography and sort of taught me a post-production workflow so that I could do it all by myself.
Wow.
And so that's how it came about. So essentially I was able to shoot a 3D movie with the RED camera with almost no money whatsoever.
Oh my God.
it was really great.
Yeah.
And I don't know, like, how many people have that opportunity yet, but a lot more probably will.
Yeah.
You know, so I mean, like you're saying, it's the only 3D indie film that you can think of. It's the only one I've been able to find too, and I've been looking really hard. There's a girl in France whose name I don't recall who made a really arty 3D, don't say arty, but who made a 3D indie film last year.
Yeah.
That played really well in some 3D festivals. But this is Annie Goes Boating getting into South By, I think, is the first time that I've heard of a 3D indie drama like actually getting into a mainstream festival.
Yeah.
And in order, it was, and I think that really happened because Joe Nicolosi invited me to be on this 3DIY panel, and then convinced the programmers that it made sense to also show my film.
Yeah,
I was going to be down here on the panel.
Yeah.
Or something. But it got in, and so we were able to screen it, and I had to bring a projection system to Austin from Seattle in order to make it happen. Because, you know, when you go and watch a 3D film in a theater, what you're watching is a digital file called a DCP playing back. And it's really expensive to make those because it's a proprietary codec.
Yeah.
Right? And so it's obviously, it's like way out of my range to do that.
Sure.
And I guess there's like ways coming to do it cheaper, but right now it's the kind of thing, it's like the ceiling, you know?
Yeah.
And so South by Southwest said, well, one of the venues that we're going to show your film in can handle a DCP if you can make one. I said, I can't, so I just had to bring my own system.
Yeah.
And I suspect that that's the way it's going to be for a while to come. Yeah. But I don't know. I feel like a lot of other people are going to start shooting 3D in lots of different genres and a lot of festivals. You know, it's not like every city in America doesn't have at least one 3D-enabled theater at this point. Sure. So most festivals will be able to start showing 3D, I hope.
And I don't know. It's funny because this is really the perfect forum to discuss this here at South By.
Yeah.
Because I do know that there is... I don't know if you remember what it's called. There is a movement for digital projection, for independent, open digital projection, because DCP is, you said, it's mired in legal kinds of crap, which makes it very expensive. So I don't know if you've come across that for 3D.
I haven't. I don't know anything about it, but I totally support it.
Yeah.
So another aspect of that was really appealing to me with Annie Goes Boating. Specifically, I wanted to make a film. Let's talk about what the film is about.
Sure. Yeah.
I wanted to make a film about just some people, sort of kids around my age, the kind of people I hang out with and see and drink with at bars, just playing, you know, at play, at a park, and I wanted it to be the kind of film that just gave you a sort of really naturalistic glimpse into this ongoing life, but didn't teach you a lesson or try and make some kind of a weird point or whatever. So I just tried to paint a picture of this group of people, show what their sort of social dynamic was, give you just a little bit of information about them. Oh, there's a love triangle, you know, these two are making out, but he's got a girlfriend, and then just leave. And I thought that might work particularly well in 3D, because I think that I don't think this will always be the case, but right now in 3D, I feel like unless you're a little kid, 3D can be actually a barrier between you and sort of the emotional space of a story, because it's you're more aware of the medium and the illusion, and you've got these glasses on, so you've got this actual physical barrier between you and the screen, and you know, so I think it's harder to emotionally engage with 3D movies, and we're just not used to being asked to do so, especially not in a way that's sort of I really like the kind of film where you get emotionally involved with the characters because you spend time with them. I think Audrey the Trainwreck was like that. You know, it's like you don't really know why you're watching these people, but you spend enough time with them, you start to love them, right? And as opposed to movies where it's like, this is the problem and we've got to solve it. It's really plot driven, you know, and sappy music that makes you feel a certain way at a certain time.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
I'm not interested in making that kind of movie as much, and so I thought, you know, well, what do you do then if you're trying to make... First of all, it needs to be short, because you don't have the resources to make something long yet, which I didn't. Second of all, you know that you're fighting an uphill battle in terms of getting people to emotionally engage with your characters if you're not spoon-feeding them. And then third, you know, people are just not used to the medium yet. So what we decided to do is just embrace that and so there's a scene in Annie Goes Boating, early on, where everyone just is sitting around and no one's talking. And if you watch that, in 2D on a small screen on Vimeo or YouTube, it's this is so boring. But in 3D, it super works, because it's just so interesting to sit and look at people in 3D, because it's something we haven't seen a lot of yet. So maybe in 5 years it'll seem really boring, because we'll all be used to it by then. But right now, I think it works. Yeah.
I'm not sure if this is the scene you're talking about, but there were a few shots, or maybe it's just in my head, where the characters are extremely small in the frame.
Yeah.
Where and there's a couple. There might be a bush in the foreground, and there's water in the background.
Yeah.
And it's the kind of thing where exactly what you're saying. In 2D, I'd be like, I can't see their faces. They're so far away from me. But in 3D, it's like, it's a complete experience, and I'm looking all over the place, and I'm still engaged with what they're talking
about. Well, yeah, and that was another thing. I mean, you know, we tried really hard to take advantage of the fact that we're shooting in 3D, because it's a difficult and new mindset, basically, and I'd never done it before, to think about, well, how does what I'm filming, how do I use that depth as not just, I mean, Jean Renoir uses compositional depth, and Ozu and a lot of filmmakers use compositional depth as a huge part of their mise-en-scène or whatever, right?
Sure.
But when you actually have the perception of depth because of 3D, it really changes what you can do. And so, you know, one of the main things about Annie Goes Boating is I really wanted it to feel like an impressionist painting, you know. And there are a lot of like really overt references to Impressionist paintings. I love the Impressionists, and yeah. I feel like they get a bad rap a lot in art school. It's like not hip to like the Impressionists.
Yeah.
Everyone's like, you like Monet, you like Renoir. Oh, they're so sentimental. But they're not.
Yeah.
You know, they weren't at the time. They right. still aren't, I think. But so I wanted to shoot something like outdoor with lots of wide shots with like tons and tons of leaves and fine detail in the natural environment and dappled sunlight, and I got really lucky with the weather most of the time, and then it rained, which wasn't in the script, so we just sort of changed up the story to accommodate it. But when you're shooting people playing badminton and you can't move the camera and you don't have the resources to do any artificial lighting, and you're outside in dappled sunlight in a big park, it's really difficult to you know, a lot of the wide shots in the film are very, very busy and encumbered in 2D, whereas when you see them in 3D, like, everything sort of separates out.
Yeah, sure.
And it feels very natural. And, you know, there was, I think we, like, used a bounce or a light in one close-up at the very end of the last day of shooting, and the rest of it is just, like, setting up the camera and going.
Yeah.
So there are a lot of things like that, and there are a lot of, like, really deep, wide, like, deep shots, too, that...
Yeah.
are really cool in 3D because you have this action that's so far away, and then you have stuff in the foreground too, and the camera's just sitting there, and there's not a ton of action in the characters, so your eye is really free to wander from the foreground to background.
Yeah.
And that's another aspect of 3D that I was really interested in exploring, because it seems to be a bit of a descent from what the current, you know, philosophy is. And so, you know, you have, like, with Avatar, they shot it with the Pace Rig, which is, this, like, the most badass camera rig ever made. But it's a converged system, so the lens is actually, like, your cameras actually converge on whatever they're filming.
Okay.
Right? And that the convergence of the cameras is tied to their focus, tied to their interaxial distance. And
when you say converge, you mean they're sort of facing each other?
The lens actually point in.
Okay.
Right? And so what that does is it throws the whatever's in the deep background into divergence.
Okay.
And so it asks your eye to... And there's, I mean, there's sort of a debate about it, because that's more like how our eyes actually work in some ways.
Mm-hmm.
But it also makes shooting in nature less comfortable, because if I'm shooting a close-up of you and I converge my cameras on you, it necessarily throws the background, like, way out of... like, way into divergence.
Okay.
In the opposite direction. And so you can't really look from the foreground to the background comfortably.
Okay.
So the background's like that. And it's sort of more like what it really looks like to your real eye, but it's not how we experience it, really. Well, the rig I used doesn't do convergence. There's a parallel rig. So the cameras, I mean, they're at a right 90-degree angle beam splitter.
Okay.
The cameras never converge in. And what that allows you to do is it allows you to, as long as you set your interocular distance correctly, it allows you to never have the background go so far out of divergence that it becomes uncomfortable,
okay.
which means you can create compositions that your eye is free to wander, right? And I mean, I think James Cameron is like a genius and a massive innovator, and I'm not criticizing, but
yeah.
I've definitely like seen some interviews where he said that he thinks in 3D it's even more important than in 2D film to like always guide people's eye and tell them exactly where to look. And his camera system does exactly that. It's
right.
like, look here now, this is what we're focusing on, this is what's converged for you in 3D. And in, you know, anytime anyone says, here's a rule, as an art student with no money, you say, I'm going to break that rule. And so, you know, that was one of the points in Annie, was to sort of set up some compositions that were very static, very open, where everything's in focus and everything is comfortable to look at in 3D, so that your eye can just kind of roam around.
Yeah.
And I feel like we actually like did that in a few places.
Yeah.
That's cool. At the same time, obviously, you always want to guide people's eyes, you know, and part of the art of stereography is to know how to set up the depth cues in a way that is pleasant and not distracting, you know. So you try not to like jump from a shot where everything's deep back behind the screen to something where everything's right in your face, unless you have a really good reason to do that.
Yeah. You mentioned the Impressionism as an influence on the look of the film.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm curious, because sort of watching it, I kind of felt like it was almost like 100 years ago and I was seeing 3D for the first time. Almost like, forget what they're called, like the little stereographs that you use.
Yeah, stereogram things.
Yeah, stereogram things. I'm just curious, you know, in terms of the history of this technology, which has been around a lot longer than anyone realizes.
Yeah.
Did you sort of research at older looks, you know, like what kind of films in terms of 3D?
Well, what I did is the first thing I did when I started getting into 3D is I bought a bunch of old stereograms, and I got an old, like, turn-of-the-century stereograph viewer thingy on eBay for, like, $60.
Yeah.
It's beautiful. Mm-hmm. It's, like, antique. And I, you know, these things were like the household television in the 1860s and like latter half of the 19th century. Everyone in Europe and everyone in the United States, every family had one. And they all had a big collection of little stereograph card things. And it was like a mainstream form of entertainment. And it's not anymore. It's been completely lost.
Yeah.
I think what's interesting to me is like, I mean, we're talking about like how people aren't used to stereo right now. But kids are getting more used to it. But it's crazy because, like, our great-grandparents were totally used to it. So the genres of these stereograph cards, there's, like, a few genres, and they had a massive influence on early film. The genres were stuff like little moral tales. Like, there'd be, like, you know, a wicked-looking guy, like, trying to break down a door, and there's some girls in it, and it's like, keep him out, ladies. You know, and then there's, like, a... Then there's sort of like wonders of the world type cards, like architect, like the Taj Mahal and stuff like that, and then there's a lot of them that are, and then there's a lot of sort of documentary type of things, but then there's a lot that are kind of like very much like the kind of subject matter you see in Impressionist paintings, which is sort of like, you know, the young bourgeoisie or sort of like working class, like, you know, petty bourgeois or whatever, like just at play during their leisure time, like canoeing or whatever, like boating and stuff like that, on swings, stuff like that. There are a lot of cards like that, and they really reminded me of Impressionist paintings. So that was like one kind of weird tie-in. And I just liked that so many of these old stereographs were just these weird slice of life images. It's weird, you know. It's like it's not the kind of like mainstream entertainment we're used to anymore.
Yeah.
You know. So there was that. I didn't try to make the film like look old, but what I did try and do is really model it after a lot of the kind of subject matter that I appreciate in the Impressionist paintings, and so it's very much like, you know, young people in their free time just hanging out.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, they're sitting around at a, I mean, in the film all they do is they sit around and drink some wine at a picnic, and then they play badminton, and then two of them go off in the bushes and kiss, and those are all, you know, like, oh, and they boat.
Yeah,
you know, they row around on boats. And those are all like kind of like total cliches from Impressionist paintings.
Right.
You know, and then there's, and then, you know, there's a girl with a little dog, which is a straight up Renoir thing. There's a composition in there, which is a straight up Manet, like Dejeuner sur l'herbe. There's like a girl with an umbrella, which is a straight up Monet shout out. So there's sort of a lot of little references like that that I don't, you know. Hopefully they don't, like, encumber the film too much, but they were really fun to sort of do. And it's funny because the way I described the film to the actors, I was able to work with some incredible actors, and most of them, I didn't have a chance to rehearse with almost anyone because they were kind of coming from all over the place and all really busy. So most of them read the script, and a few of them were like, this seems like a period piece, but it's not.
Yeah.
So I don't know. Maybe some of the spirit of that is in it, which I hope so. It's cool.
Yeah. No. I mean, it definitely. I think the look of it in terms of looking like a painting, I guess, would be the only part that feels like a period piece. But I definitely know, you know, kids at play, as you said, who would certainly have a day like this, I guess.
And I think that you always try really hard to make films like the people you want to make films like. But you can't, no matter how hard you try, because you live in your time and they lived in theirs. And so I like Jean Renoir's, Pierre Auguste Renoir's son, is my favorite filmmaker ever. And so this Annie Goes Boating is in a lot of ways a direct homage to his film Party de Campagne, which is A Day in the Countryside, which is a beautiful film that has a lot of similarities. And I just was trying to make a Renoir film, essentially, but you can't because you live in your time and someone else, and you have to be true to your own culture.
And he was also like a like a vicious special effects innovator too, right?
What I love about Renoir is he has an art school background. There weren't art schools when he had the best art school of anyone because he grew up around Renoir and Cézanne and all those guys. But he started filmmaking really interested in technical innovations.
Yeah.
And the more he did it, the more experience he gained, the more he became interested in stories and humans and the drama and the art of acting. And I think by the time he died, he was considered a great actor's director, or by the time he reached his prime anyways.
Yeah.
When he started, I mean, he made films for a long time that were really fringe, experimental, arty things that were extremely technical. And that resonates with me just because I come from an art school background and you know, this is really the first time, except for one student project that doesn't count. This is my last student film, I guess, right? But it's the first time I've really tried to tell a story ever and not had... And it's still, I mean, it's technically innovative in the sense that it's 3D, but it's sort of an opposite kind of technical innovation because it's like, what if we use 3D to do this kind of film that everyone has seen before, but maybe not in 3D, you know?
Yeah, sure.
So, that's one thing about Renoir that I really resonate with.
Yeah, definitely.
And just his whole vibe and spirit. I love the way that both he and his dad's paintings kind of, they just really like celebrate life. They just have this sort of joy and like richness. And even though they're not, to me, I never have found it sentimental. I've always found it to be like entirely realistic, but also really optimistic.
Right.
And there's a vibe in that I really liked. And I wanted to have some of the spirit of that in Annie Goes Boating while telling what's really a very dark story, because it's a story about a girl. Talk about the actors first of all.
Sure.
So Alessandra Torresani plays Annie, and she's from I know her through a mutual friend who's a really great fashion designer named Brian Lichtenberg.
Okay.
And I was talking with him and mentioning the project to him and asking if he knew any young actors who would have like kind of the right vibe.
Uh-huh.
And he said, you know, my homie Alessandra's living in Vancouver. It's pretty close to you right now. She's shooting this TV show up there, Caprica.
Yeah.
Here's her phone number. And so I emailed her or whatever, and she shot back instantly and was like, this sounds cool, you know, when is it shooting? And I said, well, when are you free? Weekends? But we're shooting on the weekends.
Yeah.
And so I went up to Vancouver and met her and was able to kind of really write the part for her, knowing that we wouldn't have any time to prepare. I just tried to sort of write it to her personality as much as I could. And then I had Alicia Delmore, who's in Lynn Shelton's Hump Day, who's sort of like the anchor of the cast. Davey Blue from Linus Phillips, Bass Ackwards, who's another great... She's in New York now, but she's from Seattle, I think, or was there for a long time. Sophia Goldfarb, who's a good friend of mine and often is like a stylist on my music videos. She plays the girl with the umbrella, doesn't really talk much, she's sort of the observer, she's sort of the audience's avatar. And then Sam Wilson, who's a really talented guy, a Seattle-based actor right now. And then a dude named Taylor Maxwell, who I originally cast someone else for his role. He plays Gabe, sort of the male lead. And my other actor, Quinlan, had to back out like the night before the shoot due to a severe like family like illness. And so I called up Taylor, who is going to film school in LA right now, and said, can you do me a huge favor and go to the airport like right now and get on a plane to Seattle? And he totally did it and saved the film and also completely changed the film. So the guy I'd originally cast in the role was this sort of, you know, more James Dean type, like, you know, really sort of like small, brooding, you know, like intensely powerful eyes in sort of like an edgy way, whereas Taylor is this like huge, like massive, manly dude with like his hands are bigger than Alessandra's whole head, and then he's got these beautiful, guilty and innocent looking at the same time doe eyes that completely changed his character, and it was a huge, like, you know, I mean, that stuff happens all the time, you just gotta roll with it. That was the biggest directing challenge, I think. Other than the fact that I thought it would be really easy to do a scene with six people who'd never really met before hardly at all in real life, pretending to be friends, yeah. sitting around doing nothing at a picnic, yeah. like drinking. I thought that was going to be really easy, and it turned out not so easy.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm really an experienced director of like actors and drama. But so anyways, Alessandra's character, Annie, is the main character. And she is that girl who is, you know, allowing herself to be with a dude who's cheating. And it's such a compromising place to be, and I was really interested in just painting a really simple portrait of the ambivalence of that. Because there's a lot of, I don't know, there's a lot of ambivalence. And so, I don't know how that relates to 3D, but there is a relief. But that's what the film is about. Is, yeah. And we really tried to approach it as just this portrait. Because there wasn't really a lesson. It's very dark because you don't, like, no one changes, no one learns. There's no one has a character arc.
Yeah.
You know, no one, like, it's not like you see some resolution. All that happens is that you are brought into this group dynamic. You see that there's this deceit going on in it, and then you see them get seen by the girl with the umbrella,
right?
Who's basically like the audience. She doesn't say anything. She just sees it,
yeah.
and then the film ends.
Yeah.
And so, you know, it's like a really dark story, you know. And it's kind of we wrote it to be open to interpretation a little bit. So some people have seen it and they're like really turned off and think it's really cynical, and some people think it's really beautiful. And I think that it's open enough that if you want to, or if you engage at all, you have a tendency to see something in the character.
Yeah.
And I like that, you know. I feel like,
sure.
So I, some people have seen it and reacted to it in a way that I feel like, wow, what a success. You know, I'd like really like, I did it, you know. I've kind of like made a film that is open and creates a world that is big enough that you can explore and not know exactly what I'm trying to say, but not feel like I haven't said anything.
Yeah.
And then other people watch it and they're like, you haven't said anything.
So, yeah.
You know, whatever.
Yeah, no, totally. You can't please everyone. I mean, my own personal reaction was just that being engaged for 10 minutes was good enough for me. You know, like, I really don't want to figure out what the characters are about, you know, what the next decision is, what the resolution is.
Right.
And that's just me personally. That leaves me much happier because I can sit with it and think about it.
The kind of film I really like are the kind of films where you spend time with the characters and that's how you get to know them, and you don't necessarily know why at first.
Yeah.
I really like that kind of like pace of life kind of filmmaking. And what we discovered is it's extremely difficult to do that in a short film because you don't have much time.
Sure.
Right? And so you have to really limit yourself to what you can show. And I wrote the film with Katie, who's my wife, and also she did the sound design and she also did the music for it. And she also gave me most of the good ideas for editing the film. You know, so it was a huge collaboration. But while we were writing it, you know, the story got pared down more and more and more and more and more and more. And as it plays now, it's not tremendously talky. In the original draft, like the original cut of the film was 14 minutes long. This is 10.
Yeah.
And the original cut of the film is like non-stop talking.
Really?
And there's so many characters and we're trying to get across so much sort of expositionary information that everyone we were showing the draft to was just overwhelmed. And they're like, I don't know who's who. I don't know what's going on. I have a vague sense that she shouldn't be kissing that guy at the end. And that's all.
Right.
You know? And so we realized, well, okay, no one's going to know what's going on. No one's going to know who's who. So let's not try and explain everything.
Sure. With
all this dialogue. So we just axed a few scenes entirely. And then we took the picnic scene, completely gutted it of all dialogue, and made it so that you're just sitting there with people in silence for the most part. And it's so much better that way.
Huh.
And it wasn't until I was able to actually see it projected in 3D that I knew that I could do that and get away with it. Because in 2D and really small, it didn't work as well.
When you cut it, you're not seeing a 3D image while you're cutting.
Okay, so the post-production workflow, I'm not able to afford like a 3D monitor at this point, so I learned to Freeview, which is where you put the image for your left eye on the right side and the image for your right eye on the left side, and then you cross your eyes and bring them into convergence. And so essentially what you're doing is you're crossing your eyes as if you're looking at your hand right in front of your face, but you're focusing beyond it, like 3 or 4 feet away, like where your computer screen is.
While you're editing.
And it's really uncomfortable at first, but then once you get used to it, your eyes can totally do it. You just have to sort of decouple convergence and focus. So once it happens, like, once you get it, you're able to, like, work on any normal monitor. So I cut the film just in 2D, Final Cut Pro.
Yeah.
And then once I had my edit, I went into After Effects, and the guys at Lightspeed set up a workflow for me, basically. It allowed me to do all my alignments and, you know, match up the images and sort of color correct them and all that stuff in 3D, crossing my eyes. So I did all of post-production on one computer that way, and then at the very end started actually rendering stuff out. And I was working on a Mac. Their system is all PC-based, so I had to, like, render stuff and then, like, transfer it onto a PC, re-encode it. And then we were able to start looking at stuff projected large, and that changed everything. I mean, because, you know, I mean, like you're saying, like, there's the scenes where people are really small in the distance. Those scenes were really, it was really scary to know how many of those shots you could put in, how long you could leave them on the screen. There are, like, mathematical ways to figure out, like, where stuff's going to lie in depth and, like, in your 3D field or whatever. But but you just don't know how it feels until you see it big.
Yeah, sure.
I think what's going to happen is that as the technology becomes more and more available, everyone who's shooting 3D is just on set. They're just going to have a projector and be able to project stuff large just to make sure it feels right big. Because I think that, you know, then you don't need the math. But there's also, like, there's an iPhone app now that tells you, like, how to do a lot of the 3D math and stuff like that.
I guess this will probably lead into the last question, I guess. Mm-hmm. By my count, I'd say we're probably in, like, around the third wave of 3D filmmaking trying to take off. Maybe the second, I don't know.
I feel like it happens every 10 years or so.
Yeah, something like that. Starting in around the 50s, I guess. I don't know if it happened earlier than that.
Yeah, I'm not an expert, but, like, it definitely is, like, a cycle. Yeah.
But, you know, the amount of investment from top down happening this time, I wonder if it's going to stick. I want to know your opinion. Is it going to stick? And most importantly, are people like you going to keep on doing this? Will like, sort of the avatars and the ups and all of those kinds of films trickle down so that it eventually gets embraced by the independent community?
I don't know. I mean, I don't think I'm qualified to have any kind of opinion on if it's going to stick or not.
Sure.
I mean, I think the fact that the big 3D films are making money is really, maybe says something. I think a lot of video games are going to start going 3D, which is really awesome. I've seen some, like, demos of like, first-person shooters in 3D, and they look so rad. I mean, they look really,
really
cool. In terms of, like, you know, and then there's, like, more resources for it. I mean, there are more 3D monitors and, like, home systems that are going to come out and stuff like that.
Yeah.
But for the foreseeable future, everyone's still going to have to wear glasses. Whether or not it'll stick, I don't really. Who knows? It's impossible to predict. Will I keep trying to do, like, 3D indie films when I can? Yeah, totally.
Yeah.
I mean, I think that it's a medium, and it's, like, a way to use the medium that just hasn't been done very often, and it's more and more possible, so why not do it?
Yeah.
You know, and other people are going to do it just regardless of me or anything else, just because the technology is just like, I mean, back to Impressionist painting.
Sure.
Impressionism partly happened because they invented paint in tubes, right? And so when paint was in tubes and not in jars, it was, like, really easy to travel with it, so everyone started being able to go paint outside, so they'd go walk somewhere to some riverside and then do a painting.
Yeah, sure.
And so that artistic revolution is, like, entirely enabled by the technology becoming available. And, you know, so what I do know is the technology is becoming available, so there are the you know, preconditions for an artistic revolution. So if more people start making, you know, like, art films in 3D, quote unquote, great. I think that's really cool. You know, so.
No, definitely.
And I hope people will. I'm gonna try and keep doing it if I can. It's it's not easy to do, and I have been lucky while I've been in school to have this sort of, like, perfect convergence of resources. It allowed me to do it with almost no budget whatsoever.
Sure.
But it's not, like, sustainable to work that way.
Right.
Know? So.
I mean, you made it for less than $500 million, right?
Yeah, so, a lot less.
So that certainly says something. I mean, it certainly says that people can be making movies this way. I guess, did it hinder your schedule? Were you at, like, about how much less do you think you were able to shoot a day? Or were you on about the same schedule?
Well, the camera rig, I'll give you a picture of the camera rig. The camera rig with the tripod weighed, like, almost 200 pounds. It was this big box. We didn't have a dolly, so the only moving shot is when one time Mike, my DP, and Stefan, my good friend and guy I make music videos with, we stupidly put the camera on the tripod on a rowboat and, like, rowed around in Seattle's Arboretum. It was really scary.
Yeah.
But we got a moving shot that way. Everything else, like, the only camera movements are pans and tilts. And it's more time consuming to shoot 3D.
Sure.
Because every time you move anything, you have to, like, redo all your math. But what was really fun is that I've always shot digital. I've never had a chance to shoot film. I've never had the money to do it, or the desire, I guess.
Yeah.
And unlike what I've usually done, which is, like, you can, like, kind of move around, leave the camera rolling all the time, you know, it's really sloppy sometimes shooting digital. With the 3D, it was, like, way more, like, I would go figure out where I wanted to put the camera, use a viewfinder to figure out what lens was appropriate, and then I'd be like, here, put the camera here. And then Mike would set up the camera, and then I'd be with the actors, and I wouldn't touch it again.
Yeah.
Period. Because if I was like, I want it, like, 3 more inches to the right, then we had to redo all the math, reset, like, the interocular between the cameras. It's tremendously time-consuming. Mm-hmm. So I was forced to follow a discipline of shooting that was closer to shooting film, which was really good for me and actually kind of fun and challenging. We were able to move pretty quickly because we didn't have a 3D monitor on set. We were doing everything by the numbers. We were shooting on red, so we had some resolution to spare, so we aligned the cameras at the beginning of every day, and then we just hoped that they would stay aligned.
Yeah.
I think, you know, if you're shooting, like, a high-end commercial or something, and you maybe can't take that kind of a risk, but we were able to shoot outdoors in nature with no lighting, you know, just kind of running around with this rig as fast as you can run around with a 200-pound camera.
Wow.
So it was slower paced than some things that I've done, but at the same time, it was pretty efficient. And we shot, like, I don't know, like, for 4 days, I think. And by the end, I mean, the crew was, like, operating, like, super efficiently. It was really cool. So.
Wow.
Yeah.
So, where can people find the film? Is it still playing here at the festival?
Well, you can watch the trailer online on YouTube in 3D using the YT3D thing. There's another screening, South by Southwest, on Wednesday the 17th at 11:30 a.m. It screens with a feature called Audrey the Trainwreck. And then beyond that, I don't know. I'm hoping that it'll play in a few more festivals, but it's so difficult to bring it to festivals because I have to bring my own projector. It may not be an easy film to get to see for a long time to come.
Yeah.
But, because I don't want to release it in 2D. It's not the same.
No, yeah, totally. And what's next for you?
I'm not entirely sure.
Yeah.
Working on writing projects, pitching on music videos, and hoping to do something else in 3D soon.
All right, awesome. Well, I hope we get to see that.
Yeah.
All right, thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you.